A week and a half after the Italian earthquake, and crews are still working in many of the worst hit areas, including the town of Amatrice. But there were many small villages and hamlets hidden away that suffered as well. Residents, who are now facing an uncertain future as winter approaches, have issued a plea for people not to forget about them. Our Europe correspondent, Lisa Miller, was on the ground in Italy.
Rescuers and volunteers and an army of media trucks descended on the small villages in central Italy in the hours after the earthquake. It's the same after most tragedies, whether they're natural catastrophes or horrific massacres. There's a rush of activity as everyone is stirred from their sleep and coverage is organised. Reporters nod knowingly to each other in airport departure lounges. The baggage carousels spit out heavy cases filled with camera equipment. Central Italy sits on a series of fault lines, and there have been dozens of lethal shocks over the centuries. It took us around 7 hours to get from the London office of the ABC to Amatrice, flying into Rome and then driving into the mountains. It's a track so many tourists have taken for years. We drove as close as we could to the site and walked the rest of the way. There was a sense of confusion and so much noise. Huge semi-trailers were bringing in heavy equipment, trying to pass each other on roads barely wide enough for a small car. Metal scraped against paint, but damage to vehicles was the least of their worries. They grabbed road signs and pulled them out of the ground and removed wire fences to make room for the trucks. Locals stood on street corners watching rescuers use bulldozers and heavy equipment to lift parts of buildings. I watched as they worked on a house, or what had clearly been one.
I'm watching about a dozen rescuers coming back out of a house that's been completely destroyed. All you can see the solar panels on top and the chimney that's still remaining standing. They've had the bulldozer going, trying to remove some of the stones and bricks. They think that there might still be people in there.
We talked to residents hanging on their every word, desperate for some insight into their lives and their losses. Their cars, homes, possessions, all gone. A young woman waits while rescuers try to find her family in a crushed house. They bring out a jewellery box, a framed photograph, and a clutch of papers. My colleague Jeff Lai films the scene and is berated by a Red Cross worker in Italian. You don't need to understand the language to grasp her anger. Finding the balance between recording this horror and respecting people's grief is always difficult. We stayed for 4 days and then left, as many of the media did. Thousands of locals are now left behind in tents throughout this region. The nights are already getting cooler, and in the more remote villages, they're wondering what it will take to make these places habitable again. The mayor of Amatrice, which suffered the biggest loss, has vowed that this medieval town will be rebuilt. But what of the smaller villages, hidden away from view? On the map, there is only 27 kilometres separating Amatrice and Pescara del Tronto. But the drive took us more than 2 hours as we were diverted around roadblocks and taken along a twisting mountain path. Will the Italian government follow through with promises to rebuild all these towns, or will some be forgotten? Don't abandon us, the locals plead. If they take any cues from the residents of L'Aquila, which suffered in 2009 from a terrible earthquake, then they'll not hold out great hope that anything will happen quickly. Despite it being 7 years since that disaster that killed more than 300 people, many of the displaced remain in temporary housing and parts of the city remains a construction zone. This is Lisa Miller for Correspondence Report.
In China, the massive state-owned enterprises that dominate the old economy of steel, coal and construction are seen as a major cause of the country's economic slowdown. Also known as zombie companies, many of them are hugely inefficient, yet the Chinese government refuses to restructure or close them. Propped up by debt, they continue to flood the world markets with cheap steel. That's led to the closure of steel mills in America, the UK, and it's threatening Australia's industry too. Our China correspondent Matthew Carney went to one of the Chinese steel cities to investigate.
It's like a scene from a bygone industrial age. I'm in the city of Bunqi in northeastern China, and a massive steel mill sits right in the middle of town. Smoke continuously pours out from the dozen chimneys that tower in the skyline, and soot is dropped all over the city. The air is so heavy with pollution that you literally feel your body being poisoned as you breathe it in. About 1 million people live around the steel mill, packed in tight in drab concrete apartment blocks. It's not attractive. The steel mill utterly dominates the city. The massive state-owned enterprise employs more than 100,000 people. And if it were to close, the whole city would go with it. Standing on a mountain overlooking Bunqi, you do get an understanding of why the Chinese government is going slow in restructuring these monoliths. The mass unemployment and social upheaval that would follow would threaten the stability that China so dearly values. So for the moment, the workers are keeping their jobs and are being cushioned from the realities of the market. At the afternoon shift change, we venture to the front gates to speak with the workers, and they seem to have no idea that their jobs are under threat.
Lose our job? Impossible. Never thought of it. I feel I can't lose my job so easily. The factory belongs to our country and to our province.
Then we talk to someone from management, and he says wages have been cut by a quarter over the last 2 years, but says the steel mill can't be closed. There seems to be a denial mentality in Bunqi.
It won't happen to Bunqi Steel. The privately run enterprises may be hit, but our factory is a big state-owned company. There are nearly 100,000 staff. The government and the factory itself will solve the problems. Our factory leaders are competent.
But he does acknowledge, to safeguard the city, they should diversify.
The city only depends on one industry. So when it goes down, the people won't be able to live a life anymore. So we should have a structural adjustment and diversify the economy. We haven't met our production growth targets, so we do need to prepare and become a more pluralistic society to meet the risks.
But the problem is that the Chinese have gone on a massive credit binge to keep the state-owned enterprises running, and it's happening at an unprecedented rate. In the last decade, debt has doubled to 250% of GDP. And economists say it's a time bomb for the Chinese economy that could lead to a prolonged slowdown like the Japanese stagnation, or worse, a financial crisis like the GFC of 2008. All other economies that had a similar rapid increase in debt have been met with a crisis. So the real dilemma for the Chinese authorities is when and how to pull the plug on some of their more inefficient state-owned enterprises. There is 150,000 of them, so it's going to be painful for millions of Chinese workers. The Chinese government is already planning how to transit workers from steel and coal into new industries like services and high tech. But standing on a hilltop, looking at the steel city of Bunqi, it's obvious the transition is going to be huge and dislocate millions and ultimately change where and how people will live. This is Matthew Carney reporting for Correspondence Report in northeastern China.
This week, Australia became the first country to be dragged into compulsory conciliation talks in The Hague under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. The dispute is over maritime borders in the Timor Sea, in an area that contains oil and gas deposits worth tens of billions of dollars. In 2006, a treaty signed between Australia and East Timor put a hold on any negotiations over a permanent maritime boundary. But East Timor wants that treaty torn up after it was revealed that Australia bugged the cabinet room in Dili in 2004, gaining what is widely seen as an unfair advantage in negotiations. Steve Kinnane was in The Hague for Correspondence Report.
The Hague is one of those cities you often hear about in the news. It's half an hour's train ride from Amsterdam, and it's the place the former UN Secretary-General Boutros Boutros-Ghali once described as the legal capital of the world. It's here that you find the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, and the Permanent Court of Arbitration. And this week, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, situated behind the grand gates of the Hague's Peace Palace, hosted a landmark case involving Australia. In April, East Timor triggered a compulsory conciliation process under the UN's Convention on the Law of the Sea over the disputed territory in the Timor Sea that contains large oil and gas deposits worth an estimated $40 billion. It's the first time that conciliation hearings like this have occurred under the convention. The case is about territorial boundaries, sovereignty, and money. Back in 2006, Australia and East Timor signed a treaty that divided up revenue from the oil and gas fields in the Timor Sea. As part of this treaty, East Timor agreed to put on hold any negotiations over a permanent maritime boundary for 50 years. But now East Timor wants the treaty torn up, after revelations that Australian foreign intelligence agents planted listening devices in the cabinet rooms in Dili back in 2004. It was an operation done under the cover of a renovation project being conducted by an aid agency. Transcripts of the conversations being held by East Timor's team during their confidential meetings were typed out and then delivered to Australia's negotiating team, giving them an advantage during the treaty talks. East Timor did not find out about this until 2012. This operation has outraged the senior leadership in East Timor, who consider the act of espionage to be a crime committed against a poor and vulnerable nation who were trying to drag its people out of poverty. Janana Gusmao, the father of East Timorese independence, said to me last year, "It is immoral, very immoral, this kind of spying. We are not terrorists." East Timor wants the 2006 treaty annulled, and instead wants a median line boundary drawn up between the two countries consistent with international law. It's what the English offered Norway in the 1960s when they were negotiating a maritime boundary over the oil-rich North Sea. The Norwegians accepted the offer in quick time. Australia, though, argues that the 2006 treaty is consistent with international law and that the 50-year moratorium on negotiating a permanent boundary should remain. As Gary Quinlan from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade put it, the Commission should not disregard the treaties simply because one party has changed its mind. After the first day of hearings, in which both parties made opening statements in public, the proceedings moved behind closed doors. Australia then made its case that the Commission should not even be hearing the dispute. The Australian delegation believes a signed treaty trumps the conciliation hearings. East Timor argues that Australia exploited a weak nation in the negotiations over the treaty. A decision about whether the Commission has jurisdiction over this dispute could be made in a matter of weeks. At the beginning of the second day of hearings, Janana Gusmao urged Australia to respect international law. "Australia used to tell others to respect international law," he told me. "They must now show us that they also abide by international law." All along, Australia has made the case that it does respect international law, and points to that 2006 treaty as being consistent with international law. But when Witness K, the senior intelligence agent who conducted the bugging operation in Dili, was due to give evidence in another case before the Permanent Court of Arbitration, his passport was seized in a raid by ASIO. When Witness K applied for a new passport last year, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop refused to issue him a passport, preventing him from travelling to The Hague to give evidence which could have embarrassed Australia. Janana Gusmao makes the case that Australia is avoiding justice in the international courts in The Hague. Back in 2002, 2 months before East Timor became independent, Australia withdrew from the compulsory dispute settlement mechanism under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. That means any decision made by the commissioners in the conciliation process will not be binding on Australia. If East Timor does get the result it wants, it might be a moral victory rather than a legal one. This is Steve Kinnane for Correspondence Report.
Hardly a day goes by in the United States without some reminder in the media of the terrible toll caused by America's recent conflicts. But it was the brutal war at home, America's Civil War, where many of the early medical lessons were learnt, and they have helped soldiers survive devastating battlefield damage ever since. There's many myths associated with the doctors who took part in that conflict, as our North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
In the town of Frederick in northern Maryland, there's an old brick building which is home to the National Museum of Civil War Medicine. It's a research institution as well as a traditional museum which uses mannequins to depict battle scenes from America's internal war. For the director of the institute, which oversees the museum, Adele Eyre, it's also a place to dispel myths, like biting the bullet.
Well, in the United States, this concept came up somehow post-war, post-American Civil War, that soldiers were biting a bullet when they were under surgery. And that, when you think about it, that's probably the least thing that you want to be biting is some metal object when you're having surgery. So where does that come from? And we believe it comes from bullets that were found on battlefields after a particular battles for years afterwards that were bitten. This myth gets into our Hollywood history. You see it in lots of movies throughout the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and I think even beyond that. But several organizations went to great length to figure out if this is true or not. And they took some of these bullets, bitten bullets, and they took them to dentists and said, "What bit this?" And most of the time, it was a pig. And during, for farmlands, which is mostly where battlefields are, their pigs run free so that they could forage. So when they see something juicy on the ground that they want to munch on, there might be a bullet in there, and hence the little bitten bullet. But it's completely erroneous.
But do you still say, you're just going to have to bite the bullet?
I don't anymore, no.
The institute, which runs the museum, is named after Jonathan Letterman, who is called the father of modern battlefield medicine. The biggest myth that Adele Eyre wants to dispel is that surgeons on the battlefield were butchers. And she says Letterman came up with a clear plan to ensure that doctors didn't operate alone.
The single most important wound that they were trying to find was the bullet to the bone. They didn't understand why, but they did know, they observed at the First Battle of Manassas that anybody that was hit with a bullet to a bone in a limb, that it appeared to be a broken bone. So they wrapped it up and waited it for it to mend. But between 24 and 48 hours, all of those men were dead. So the thought was that if we eliminate that wound, we can possibly save their life.
When you say eliminate, you're using a sawing motion.
Yes, we're talking about amputation. So the amputation is incredibly important if you have that type of a wound and that the surgeons can get to you but before that 48-hour limit in order to save their life. Before Letterman's plan, it was a lone surgeon, hopefully with what would become an anesthesiologist, so this is the birth of that profession, alone, operating on dozens, if not hundreds, of young men that have to lose that limb in order to save their lives. When Letterman's plan comes into play, he insists that there is one man that just deals with anesthesia, there are three surgeons, and that before any amputation takes place, the three of them discuss, is this necessary, and if it is, then it happens. We get better care today that because of the surgeons that were in the Civil War. They weren't actually butchers.
Tell me about the table that this amputation is taking place on.
At this particular diorama, the table that the surgery is taking place on, the museum acquired it as an artifact, as a surgery table from the Battle of Cedar Creek. And we purchased it, and it was in the museum for a number of years and on exhibit as that particular table. And some visitors came in, a gentleman with his family, and said, my great-great-great-granddad had his leg amputated at Cedar Creek, and for some reason he thought it was important to bring a piece of that table home as a souvenir. And it's been sitting on our mantelpiece for generations, and we thought, well, bring it back. Let's see if it fits. And lo and behold, after hours, we looked around on the back side, and indeed there is a little bit of a chunk that is missing, and it fit into the table like a missing puzzle piece.
That's so extraordinary.
Indeed it is, authenticated twice.
And that's all from the program this week. Thanks for your company.
Discover the best of RN on Facebook. Simply search for ABC RN.